morning. President Trump says he's begun arrangements for a meeting between the leaders of Ukraine and Russia. Now, the Kremlin is responding to potential direct talks on ending the war. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The president wants to stop states from voting by mail. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Legal experts say, though, that Trump does not have the authority to tell states how to run their elections. There's movement in the nationwide fights over redistricting. Lawmakers in California and Texas have returned to their state capitals and are pushing ahead with the redrawing of congressional maps. Democrats in Sacramento say they'll back down if Republicans in Austin do the same. It's Tuesday, August 19th. Actor Peter Gallagher is 70 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump says he started planning for a meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to end Russia's war in Ukraine. Trump says he also wants to plan another meeting that would include those two men and himself. This comes after yesterday's big gathering at the White House, where Zelensky and several European leaders met with Trump. Afterwards, Zelensky said no date has been set for the three-way meeting.
We don't have any date. We just confirmed after this productive meeting with the president and then with all our colleagues, with the partners, we confirmed that we are ready for a trilateral meeting.
President Trump says the U.S. will help with security guarantees for Ukraine, but Trump did not explain what the U.S. role might look like. He did say the Europeans would be a first line of defense for Ukraine. The House Oversight Committee says the Justice Department has agreed to provide the panel with records related to late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports the committee subpoenaed the Epstein materials earlier this month.
The Republican chairman of the House Oversight Committee, Kentucky's James Comer, says the Justice Department will begin turning over Epstein-related records this Friday. He says it will take some time for all the materials to be provided to the committee, because the department has to first redact the identities of victims as well as any child sexual abuse materials. The Oversight Committee subpoenaed the Justice Department 2 weeks ago for the files. The Trump administration has faced intense public blowback, including from some Republicans in Congress, over its handling of the Epstein matter and for failing to follow through on its pledges of transparency. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
The White House says dozens of homeless encampments have been cleared in Washington, D.C. A week ago, President Trump sent hundreds of federal agents and National Guard troops to the city. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports it's not clear where the people who have been displaced have gone.
Homeless service providers say many likely opted to stay outside, moving around to evade authorities. Some are in shelters. The city made more beds available, or hotels paid for by community members. Jesse Rabinowitz with the National Homelessness Law Center says the mass displacement will make it even harder to eventually connect people to housing.
It was so fast that I worry people were not able to save vital documents, medication, heirlooms, clothes, things like that.
The White House says it has not arrested any people for being homeless, and service providers are relieved about that. But they suggest the money this federal surge is costing could have gone toward affordable housing instead. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
Hurricane Erin is moving north through the Atlantic Ocean with top sustained winds of 115 miles per hour. It's not expected to hit the U.S. East Coast, but forecasters say it will grow in size. This is NPR. Hamas says it's accepted a ceasefire plan for Gaza. It's been strongly backed by Egypt and Qatar. This resembles a plan put forward by the Trump administration. It calls for some Israeli troops to be moved, some hostages to be freed, and more aid sent to civilians in Gaza. Israel previously agreed to this plan, but it's not clear if that agreement is still in effect. The final defendant accused of illegally selling ketamine to actor Matthew Perry has agreed to plead guilty. Perry died nearly 2 years ago after taking an overdose. Steve Futterman reports on the woman who admits she gave the drug to Perry.
Jasveen Sangha, who prosecutors say was known as the ketamine queen, has agreed to plead guilty to 5 counts, including the most serious, distribution resulting in death. Sangha is one of 5 people accused of supplying ketamine to Perry. The others have previously entered guilty pleas. When charges were announced last year, then DEA Administrator Ann Milgram talked about Perry desperately wanting the drug.
That is how he ended up buying from street dealers who sold the ketamine that ultimately led to his death.
Perry openly talked about his struggles with substance abuse. In the final 3 days of his life, prosecutors say Perry received 27 injections of ketamine. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
The Air Force's Chief of Staff, General David Alvin, says he's going to retire in coming months. He's only served 2 years of his 4-year rotation. The Pentagon did not disclose the reason for his early departure. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Procter & Gamble, maker of Z-Quil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZQuil.com. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
Russell Lee had a job, and that was something to be said during the Great Depression, when nearly a quarter of the workforce couldn't find 2 nickels to rub together. In 1936, the photographer had been snapped up by the Farm Security Administration to document the lives of ordinary Americans. For the next 6 years, he'd be living out of his car as he journeyed through 29 states. He photographed Dust Bowl migrants and miners, poverty and racism. In September 1937, Lee rolled into Craigville, a northern Minnesota logging town. There he captured a day in the life, a lumberjack with a bandaged eye, a man sleeping under a table, and 4 people enjoying a drink at a saloon. That last image would become one of Lee's most recognized when in 1982 it was used in the opening sequence of the TV sitcom Cheers.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Now we turn to Moscow to hear how the negotiations might look to Russian eyes.
Yeah, President Trump and Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky discuss whether Western powers could provide any security guarantees to guard against another Russian invasion.
Joining us to talk about what was agreed to is NPR's Russia correspondent, Charles Maines. Good morning, Charles.
Morning, Leila.
Okay, let's start with this idea of security guarantees for Ukraine. How can we expect that will be received by the Kremlin?
You know, well, hammering out the contours of these security agreements for Ukraine is seen by the West as key to any future peace deal. And Trump began by saying that Putin was on board with it.
In a very significant step, President Putin agreed that Russia would accept security guarantees for Ukraine, and this is one of the key points that we need to consider.
And now Trump has said that that could involve Europe taking on a lot of the burden. That's a quote, but with some American support, which is obviously quite vague. So we heard several proposals out yesterday. Some argued that Ukraine should have been should have what's called NATO-like Article 5 protections, the idea that an armed attack against one would be considered an attack against all. Others were calling for Western boots on the ground as peace monitors. But would that include, for example, American troops? We don't know at this point. One slightly more concrete security guarantee, President Zelensky of Ukraine confirmed that a Financial Times report that Kyiv wants to buy $100 billion, that's with a B, dollars in American weapons for its own future defense.
Now, Trump and Zelensky are calling for direct talks with Vladimir Putin. What's the Kremlin saying?
Yeah, you know, in the middle of yesterday's talks, Trump broke off for a phone call in Moscow with Putin, where Trump says Putin agreed to meet with Zelensky and also in this trilateral meeting. Now, late last night, Putin's aide Yuri Ushakov confirmed Putin and Trump had talked for some 40 minutes. And Ushakov said, and I'll quote here, the possibility of raising the level of direct contacts between Moscow and Kyiv was discussed. So you can take that however you like. Zelensky later gave his version in more succinct terms. Let's listen. So here Zelensky said Russia had called for a one-on-one meeting with Putin and Zelensky before a follow-on meeting that would include Trump as well. And Zelensky had accepted. He said that only on the level of leaders could the most painful and important issues be discussed. And this presumably would mean these discussions about possible future land concessions or swaps, in President Trump's words, as well as the return of prisoners and children abducted by Russia. But in terms of when, where, that's all to be determined. Germany's chancellor said it could happen by the end of the month.
And how do you see these demands going over in Moscow?
Well, you know, as we heard, Trump says Putin is open to security guarantees for Ukraine. But I think one thing we've seen time and time again is that Trump is moving fast and operating in broad agreements, whereas Putin likes to zero in on details, which slows the process down. Critics would say by design, so the fighting can continue. I will say I heard a lot of red lines from Russian red lines in the discussions in Washington yesterday. You know, this idea of European troops on the ground in Ukraine, well, Russia's ruled that out categorically. Talk of Article 5-like status for Ukraine, well, Ukraine's desire to join NATO was one of the reasons Putin launched the full-scale invasion in the first place. And even Zelensky's calls for arms sales would seem to fly in the face of Putin's demands for Ukraine's demilitarization. So we'll see, but there's a lot of skepticism here, both from analysts and even pro-war nationalists, that Putin would or even could bend on these issues.
That's NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
All right, let's get a view from Ukraine on this. Dmytro Kuleba was Ukraine's foreign minister from 2020 to 2024. So, foreign minister, do you believe anything is different today after yesterday's meeting?
Well, one thing is clearly different. We avoided a clash between President Trump on the one hand and President Zelensky and other European leaders on the other hand. That's a good news that they had a constructive conversation. But when it comes to substance, to meaningful, tangible outcomes of the meeting, everything is very vague and there is more, I would say, fog than clarity on future, on possible parameters of future agreement.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how you thought President Zelensky did, considering that the February meeting in the White House did not seem to go well. But if that is the most hopeful you are, Foreign Minister, I mean, that seems like it's bare bones in terms of hopefulness that something can resolve itself anytime soon.
Well, a long journey starts with the first step. And I was pretty certain that this meeting would go well because back in February, both sides went too far and they both realized that afterwards. So, but it's very important that the idea of a meeting between leaders is still open. It's very important that there will be follow-up conversations on what security guarantees may look like. To be honest, it's very hard to imagine what kind of security guarantees will be put in place to deter Russia from further invasions, but still this conversation is important. And but again, as I said, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. And in this particular case, nothing has been agreed yet. It's
right.
Just a conversation, an important one.
And all anything can do is just imagine what those security guarantees might be, because no concrete details have really been put out there. But I'm wondering if indeed, as President Trump says, a meeting between Zelensky and Putin happens next, can a peace deal happen without a ceasefire?
That will be very hard to imagine, but we should always reserve some space for the magic of diplomacy. But what President Putin is trying to achieve, he has repeatedly stated that he wants to remove the causes of the conflict. And although he claims that one of the key causes is Ukraine's aspiration to become a member of NATO, this is not entirely true. His real cause is the existence of Ukraine's statehood, and because he wants to dismantle Ukraine as a nation. And as long as he will not change this goal from unlimited to limited, and as long as he does not abandon this goal, there will be a war of a certain level of intensity. There may be ceasefires and they will be broken, but we need a decision that will clearly make Putin understand that the goal of dismantling Ukrainian statehood is unattainable for him. Then peace will come.
How likely is that, though, that he would abandon this goal, considering that it's seemingly been a belief of his even before Russia invaded Ukraine back in 2022?
Well, that's the most difficult question to ask. It's even more complicated than how potential security guarantees may look like. We should build a construction around Ukraine, a security and political construction, whereas it will be accepted as part of the West, and Putin will have to accept the fact that Ukraine does not belong to his sphere of influence anymore. Is this possible? Yes. Can you achieve that with one or two decisions? No. It must be a network, a complex of decisions that will build this wall between Ukraine and Russia, and we will be living our lives separately.
Does a timeline matter for you right now, considering it seems like there's momentum happening? Is that something that's tangible, or at this point it's been already so long that who cares how long it takes?
Listen, I live in Ukraine, and I experienced all the drone and missile attacks together with my compatriots. And trust me, there's nothing that you want more than for all of this to end as soon as possible, because it's a nightmare. It's a daily nightmare. But we know what we are fighting for, and we will keep fighting if this is the only option that we are left with.
Dmytro Kuleba is a former foreign minister of Ukraine. Thank you very much for your thoughts on this.
The Trump administration says detainees held at the site they're calling Alligator Alcatraz now will have their cases heard before immigration judges at another South Florida detention center. NPR's Greg Allen reports that immigration officials made that announcement in response to a lawsuit over the civil rights of detainees.
Lawyers who represent people held at the detention center in Florida's Everglades say they've been unable to meet with clients at the facility in a timely manner or in a confidential setting, and that outgoing calls by detainees are monitored and recorded. They say attorneys can't even confirm their clients are held at the facility because the Federal Immigration Detainee Locator website doesn't contain information about the Everglades site. Their lawsuit said attorneys have been unable to determine which immigration court has jurisdiction over their clients' cases. But in a document filed over the weekend, the Trump administration notified the federal judge hearing the case that it has now designated the Chrome Processing Center, another federal facility in South Florida, as the immigration court that will handle their cases. That answered one of the plaintiff's key demands, and U.S. District Judge Rodolfo Ruiz said it rendered the issue moot. Judge Ruiz said he's still considering the plaintiff's request for a preliminary injunction to force the state and federal authorities to ensure detainees' rights to legal counsel are respected. Lawyers for Florida, which built and operates the facility, said there are now rooms at the Everglades site where attorneys can meet and talk with clients in a confidential setting. A lawyer for the state chalked up any delays immigration lawyers encountered in meeting with clients as a, quote, natural byproduct of the facility being stood up quickly. ACLU attorney Eunice Cho said the court should not be satisfied with that answer.
People are being held at Alligator Alcatraz in horrifying conditions. Their rights are being violated on a daily basis, and it is not acceptable for the government to say, we're going to fix this later.
Yesterday's hearing followed proceedings last week in another lawsuit challenging operations at Alligator Alcatraz. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis says he's expecting the judge in that case to rule that the hasty construction of the facility violated federal law.
This is a political thing. We get that. But we also know that we're right on the law. And if we don't win with the trial judge, you know, we'll ultimately win going forward.
Last week, DeSantis announced Florida was opening a second detention center at a shuttered prison in North Florida. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
This is NPR News.
KEXE means a lot to people, including our member services manager, Heather Johnson.
Had a little baby. He never stopped screaming for 2 years. He has since substituted that for talking nonstop. But
shout out to Alex.
Yeah, shout out to Alex. Great kid, terrible baby. There was a lot of screaming, not much sleeping. So the radio was like constantly like my friend. Like, oh my gosh, thank goodness the morning show is on. And oh, now there's somebody playing great music and everything. And it was just such a relief. And then I was working from home at that point, so I wasn't going into the office and seeing adults anyway. So it was just nice to hear adult voices, you know what was going on in this new town and know what we could do, like what I could take this little screaming thing to.
We need your support now. Go to KEXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you for being a part of this community.
PR comes from the station. And from BritBox, presenting Outrageous, a new BritBox original drama based on the scandalous true story of England's infamous Mitford sisters. Streaming this and more original series at BritBox.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at Schwab.com. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. President Trump is using his social media site to say he plans to sign an executive order barring states from using mail ballots and potentially some voting machines. But experts say Trump does not have the legal authority to tell states how to conduct their elections. Here's NPR's Ashley Lopez.
Trump said he wants to lead a movement to get rid of mail ballots and voting machines in the country. This is why he told reporters he's planning to sign an executive order that will stop states from using either.
And we, as a Republican Party, are going to do everything possible that we get rid of mail-in ballots. We're going to start with an executive order that's being written right now by the best lawyers in the country.
Trump says he wants mail ballots eliminated ahead of next year's midterms because more Democrats vote this way compared to Republicans.
And it's time that the Republicans get tough and stop it, because the Democrats want it. It's the only way they can get elected.
Despite Trump's political rationale for all this, legal experts warn that this isn't actually something he has the legal authority to tell states to do.
There's really nothing that the executive branch can do on its own in terms of direct mandates.
That's Michael Morley. He's a professor at Florida State University College of Law. He says the Constitution gives Congress, not the president, the power to regulate federal elections.
That explicitly set forth in the Constitution with regard to congressional elections, right? The Supreme Court has recognized that Congress has equivalent power over presidential elections.
And if he wanted to change this, Trump would have to go through Congress. Matt Germer with the Right of Center R Street Institute, a D.C.-based think tank, says he doesn't think that's a good idea.
He should be careful what he is wishing for. Election policy is best handled at the state level or even the local level in some circumstances. He's opening the door for other Washington, D.C. politicians, including Democrats, to push through their favorite election policies the next time they take power.
And voting rights advocates say they're worried this kind of overreach will hurt voters who are used to voting by mail. According to a federal survey of election officials last year, about a third of the electorate voted by mail. Barbara Smith-Warner is with the National Vote at Home Institute.
Efforts to eliminate this are ignoring the facts and really are just trying to undermine confidence in our elections overall.
She said this is a power grab ahead of next year's midterm elections, where control of Congress is at stake. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
The push by President Trump to ban mail-in voting and voting machines comes days after his meeting with President Vladimir Putin of Russia. Here's Trump quoting Putin when talking about their Alaska meeting with Sean Hannity on Fox News.
He said, your election was rigged because you have mail-in voting. He said, mail-in voting every election. He said, no country has mail-in voting. It's impossible to have mail-in voting and have honest elections.
To be clear, there is no evidence of this or of widespread fraud in past elections. One organization already fighting the executive branch over voting access is the Brennan Center for Justice. It's a nonpartisan law center that, along with the ACLU and others, is suing the administration over a March executive order that calls for federal voter registration forms to require proof of citizenship. The Brennan Center argues that exceeds the president's authority. Wendy Weiser is vice president of Democracy at the Brennan Center, and she joins me now. Good morning, and thank you for being on the program. Well, it appears that we don't have Wendy Weiser of the Brennan Center. She was here to talk about the election and whether it's actually rigged. The Brennan Center is already suing over the executive orders back in March that limited limited access to the vote. And it appears we still don't have Wendy Weiser. Wendy, are you with us?
Yes, I am. So hang on, I'm going to log out of the Zoom.
Good morning. I want to ask you, Wendy, when you heard the president say no more mail-in voting, what was your initial reaction?
My initial reaction was that this is not something that the president has the authority to do. In our system, the president has no authority to rewrite our election laws. In fact, he has no role in running elections at all, except to enforce congressional laws.
He has made the claim that mail-in voting is fraud. When there are mail-in ballots, there's fraud. Is there any evidence of that?
Absolutely not. This has been a claim that he has made for a number of years. This has been studied, examined, audited election after election. And the truth is, our elections, including our use of mail voting, are actually widely acknowledged as secure.
He mentioned voting machines as well, getting rid of voting machines. The president tried in his first term to seize voting machines after he lost the 2020 election. His own attorney general, William Barr, was among those who rejected that plan, said that they wouldn't be doing it. Is there reason to believe his current efforts to restrict voting would be successful?
This is not the first time this year that the president has unlawfully claimed the authority to actually set the rules for federal elections. In March, he issued a broad executive order that purported to require Americans all across the country to provide a passport or similar document to register to vote and to do a bunch of other things, including changing voting machines. Two federal courts have already blocked major portions of this executive order, saying that the president has no authority to dictate election rules for the country. So no, I don't think
Wendy Weiser, unfortunately, it looks like we have lost Wendy Weiser. She's the vice president of Democracy at the Brennan Center for Justice, and she was speaking to us about the president's declaration that he plans to get rid of mail-in voting and voting machines. This is NPR News.
What is life like when you have hearing loss, but no one can tell? For poet Raymond Antrobus, it's like living in two distinct worlds.
So I've learned how to navigate sound in this particular way. And it's, you know, a lot of that is a kind of invisible labor.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. My conversation with Antrobus on his new memoir, The Quiet Ear, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered KAXE. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to the Tuesday morning show. In just a few moments, our daily dose of phonology with John Latimer. He'll look back at his nature notes for this date, August 19th. And coming up at 7:20, John Latimer's full phenology report. We'll hear all about what he's been seeing in nature right now. Patchy fog early this morning, then gradually becoming sunny, high 75 to 80. Our lows tonight in the mid to upper 50s. And for tomorrow, patchy fog again in the morning and then sunny, highs in the low 80s. Northland Arboretum in Brainerd offers guided hikes the third Thursday of each month. That would be this Thursday at 9:30 in the morning. Hikes are 1 hour long and dogs are welcome on a leash. And Pakegama Golf Course in Grand Rapids celebrates 100 years this Saturday, August 23rd, with a 9-hole scramble at 3 p.m. Live music from String Genius is open to the public afterwards. Teams of four can register by contacting the golf shop. The Virginia Public Library has a used book sale August 20th through the 23rd at Iron Trail Motors Event Center. Hours are noon to 7 Wednesday through Friday and 9 to 1 on Saturday. Let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. United Way of Bemidji has a wine and beer tasting social this Thursday from 4:30 to 7:30 at the Sanford Center. You must be 21 years or older to attend, and it includes live music, a silent auction, and a raffle. Tickets available at unitedwaybemidji.org. The Saxon Bog near Meadowlands invites you to a reception for their artists in residence this Friday from 1 to 4 at the Lois King Education Center. These artists will focus on bog diversity and the importance of peatlands.
On today's date, August 19th, 2008, I spot a Compton tortoiseshell butterfly. This butterfly more than likely came out from hiding and resting this summer after having emerged from its chrysalis, which was probably in a birch or an aspen, and now is in the process of maybe fattening up just a little bit before winter. The butterfly will find a suitable hiding spot, maybe a pile of wood, maybe a mailbox, maybe your garage, maybe a crack in a tree. At some point, it will spot a suitable place to spend the winter, and it will disappear, but it will remain in its adult stage. And through the winter, it will freeze solid, but thanks to some amazing antifreeze in its body, the tissues won't be harmed. And then along about late March or early April, depending on the spring that we have, the Comptons will emerge, and it will be one of the first butterflies that we will see come spring.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From AG1, maker of a drinkable multivitamin now available in 3 new flavors, tropical, berry, and citrus. Learn more at drinkag1.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadil in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. The national fight over redistricting is escalating, and lawmakers in Texas and California are back to work in their state capitals.
Texas Democrats returned after fleeing the state for 2 weeks. They were stalling a newly drawn congressional map driven by President Trump. It was loud yesterday as they entered the House chambers in Austin and supporters cheered them on.
One reason they're back, California. Democrats from the Golden State have released a map to counter Texas. It could lead to 5 more Democratic seats in the U.S. House to offset the expected 5 new Republican seats in Texas. With us this morning to break it all down is Laura Fitzgerald with CAP Radio in Sacramento. So, Laura, what do we know so far about the new map in California?
So, like you mentioned, it aims to flip 5 congressional districts that Republicans hold in California. And it puts together somewhat unlikely areas. For example, one district would include communities in Modoc County all the way up north near the Oregon border with Marin County, which is way down near San Francisco. Those are 2 very politically different regions, and under this proposal, they'd have the same congressional representative. Democrats here say the plan is to vote on the map this week, and then this will go to the voters so that they can have the final say in November.
Yeah, Modoc and Marin are as different as anything could possibly be. How are Republicans responding?
Well, Republicans strongly oppose the measure, and just some context here. The reason why California is going to the voters is because the independent redistricting commission that we have here is in our state constitution. So Republicans are criticizing Democrats for sidelining that. Here's the Assembly's Republican minority leader, James Gallagher, talking about that at a press conference at the Capitol yesterday.
We should not abandon the principle of fair and independent redistricting here in California just for political expediency. But that is exactly what these maps do.
California's Republican congressional delegation has also spoken out against the bill. Republicans hold 9 out of the state's 52 congressional seats. One of them is Congressman Kevin Kiley. He's actually introduced legislation in Congress to ban mid-decade redistricting nationwide that would include the GOP-led effort in Texas. It's important to note here also that his district east of Sacramento is one of the 5 that could become bluer under the proposal.
Yeah, so what are you watching next?
Well, this proposal's on a tight timeline. The new map was just released late last week on Friday evening, and the measure was formally introduced yesterday at the Capitol. In order to get this in front of voters in November, lawmakers have to pass the bill by a 2/3 vote this week. Democrats do hold a supermajority in California's state legislature, so that passage is likely. After that, voters will weigh in on November 4th. Governor Gavin Newsom and Democratic lawmakers and the state's organized labor leaders, they've already launched a campaign for the measure, urging voters to support it before lawmakers have even sent it to the ballot. And meanwhile, Republicans are threatening to file lawsuits challenging the ballot measure. And one more thing, Democrats here say they will back down on the redistricting fight if Texas and other red states do too.
Any indication of how California voters feel about this?
You know, there's some early polling out there that shows that there's a slight majority of Californians that do view this favorably, but it's still very early in the process.
All right, that's Laura Fitzgerald, political reporter with CAP Radio in Sacramento. Laura, thanks.
Thank you, A.
As California lawmakers push to approve a new congressional map, Democrats in Texas have ended a 2-week walkout. One of those Democrats is Representative Mahela Plissa. She's the vice chair of the Texas House Democratic Caucus, and she joins me now. Good morning, and thank you for being on the program.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So the walkout is over, but the reason for that walkout is not. Republicans are still planning to vote to redraw congressional maps in their favor. So what did this walkout actually accomplish?
Well, this walkout accomplished 2 things, right? First, we were victorious in being able to kill the first called special session that the governor called that we saw was really just focused on power grabs that Donald Trump asked our governor for. Mm-hmm. And the second is that we started really a nationwide movement. We've woken people up to what's happening, not just in Texas, but around our country. And we're getting people involved. Really, this is their representation that's at stake. And so I'm just really proud to have met this moment and started this movement.
Okay, so national attention was something that was gained, but the proposed redistricting is still on the table and is expected to pass. So what are Texas Democrats planning to do next?
Well, we had to come home for the legal battle, right? Our election experts told us that we too are on tight deadlines to make sure that these maps make it in the courts and they're litigated on. We feel very confident after we just saw the Fifth Circuit Court in Louisiana rule against a Louisiana redistricting map that was racially gerrymandered. And so we have to go back to the House floor. We have to make the legal arguments on the House floor during legislative debate as to why these are racially gerrymandered maps. And we hope that when it makes it to the Fifth Circuit Court, they too will find in favor that these maps were racially gerrymandered and stop this power grab.
So your faith is with the courts. I wanted to ask you about California, though, which we just heard about. Democrats there are moving to redraw congressional maps in response to what's happening in your states, basically mirroring the effort to give Democrats more seats in California if Texas does what it's doing. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that Democrats have to meet fire with fire, right? If Republicans are choosing to change the rules in the middle of the game, Democrats have to be willing to play the new game. Look, we have always been for independent redistricting commissions. Every time we see Democrats take the gavel or take a governorship, they move to make our maps more fair, whether it's including independent redistricting committees in state constitutions like California does, or they make the system more arduous to change these maps like New York has done. And so we have always played by the rules. I think our fear is that Donald Trump isn't playing by any rules. And our concern is that if he is able to be successful in this power grab, we will see more big bad bills. We'll see more cuts in Medicaid and Medicare. We'll see, you know, Social Security be done away with. And we might even see national abortion bans go through.
And really quickly, you lead a politically divided district in a Dallas suburb. What have your constituents been telling you?
I represent one of the only swing districts out of the 150 districts in the House. And my constituents don't want us to be representatives of Donald Trump. They want us to listen to their needs. Texas just suffered a catastrophic flood. We lost over 130 people. Children were in that number. We should be focused on those people and their loss. We have a state where we're one of the lowest in per pupil funding for public education. And we need to be focused on those
issues. We'll have to leave it there. That is Democratic State Representative Mahela Plissa of Texas. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Thanks for listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. It's 5:42. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Barr. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets at 6 p.m. Monday, August 25th at KBXE in Bemidji. It's an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxe.org or you can call us at 218-326-1234 during business hours. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are the fourth Monday of the month, and the board's meeting schedule is available at kaxe.org. Patchy fog early this morning, then becoming sunny, high 75 to 80. Our lows tonight in the mid to upper 50s. Patchy fog once again tomorrow morning, then sunny and highs in the low 80s. Applications are now open for the University of Minnesota Extension Master Gardener Volunteer Program. Learn how to share science-based horticulture knowledge with people in your area. The course begins in January. The deadline to apply is October 1st. To learn more, visit z.umn.edu or contact your local extension office. And the Hubbard County Historical Society invites you to an opening celebration for the new Park Rapids History Trail this Friday from 1 to 3. The trail tells the story of Park Rapids through 23 different sites. Find more at prhistorytrail.org. Coming up at 7:20, John Latimer's Phenology Report. Right now, more from Morning Edition.
You should give as you are able because the need is immediate.
Longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media.
It's the people here who make it go. If you want a nice, independent, completely northern Minnesota media source that isn't beholden to anybody else, you have to be willing to put in a little bit of money. this is the time, this is the moment when we have to make decisions about what really is important to our community and to ourselves.
I'm Jennifer Barr. Give right now at KAXC.org. Thank you for your support.
Comes from this station and from Subaru, who, along with its retailers, is partnering with AdoptAClassroom.org to provide funding to high-needs schools and local communities for the Subaru Loves Learning Initiative. Subaru, more than a car company. From Betterment, an automated investing platform that strives to make it easy to be invested. Learn more at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Hurricane Erin is expected to be a large and powerful hurricane as it nears our east coast this week. Forecasters say it will not make landfall, but the hurricane is still triggering evacuations and flood alerts. NPR's Bill Chappell is following the storm. So, Bill, tell us about Hurricane Erin.
Hi. Hurricane Erin is about 750 miles south-southeast of Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, this morning. It has sustained winds that are maxing out around 115 miles an hour. That's a little lower than yesterday, but Erin is very large, and that's why officials on the East Coast are so alarmed. Authorities have issued mandatory evacuation orders for Hatteras Island and Ocracoke Island in North Carolina's Outer Banks. There are emergency also in those areas. Here's Dare County Emergency Management Director Drew Pearson.
I encourage all residents and all visitors to heed the evacuation order and take action to protect themselves, to protect their property, and to get up and leave now.
So Hurricane Erin is moving northwest right now. Later this week, it's expected to curve more toward the northeast and travel back out over the open Atlantic.
Now, we just heard Drew Pearson ask people to heed the evacuation order, but if it's not predicted to hit the mainland, why are we hearing about that?
So one way to think of it is if you're standing on a dock at a lake and there's a water skier coming toward you, they don't have to hit you to directly to absolutely soak you with water. They can just turn suddenly, and that's sort of what Erin is doing. This hurricane's packing a lot of water and energy. I spoke about that with Matthew Jansen. He's an engineer who studies coastal hazards at the Stevens Institute of Technology in New Jersey.
The size of the storm really sort of is correlated with the higher storm surge levels over larger swaths of area, and that tends to lead to much more dramatic impacts.
And in this case, Erin is expected to bring waves to the surf area that are 15 to 20 feet or more. Jansen says parts of the Outer Banks are especially prone to being washed out.
In some parts of that, the barrier islands may be 1,000 feet wide in some areas, so very, very vulnerable.
So officials say people who live or work in evacuated areas should prepare to cope with the effects of days of potential flooding. The flooding is going to include a main highway that runs along the Outer Banks. That is the only way emergency officials could access it if someone needs help.
Yeah, and that water skier scenario that you mentioned makes a lot of sense. Now, what's next? It's true. I completely pictured it. Now, what's next as we watch this storm? And what about other parts of the Atlantic shoreline?
Well, the warnings aren't quite as dire for those other parts of the East Coast in terms of floods, because if you've seen our map, the Outer Banks stick out pretty prominently. But forecasters say that if you're planning to go to the beach this week, beware of the water on the East Coast, because rip currents will be dangerous along most of it, all the way from Florida to Massachusetts. And, you know, another part of this, as we covered storms like this, is Erin's the first hurricane of the Atlantic season, but it's almost certainly not the last. Forecasters say another system or two could be forming in the eastern Atlantic heading our way. They're monitoring those. And climate change is part of this dynamic. Jansen told me that many experts think we might see fewer hurricanes, but they're likely to be more intense. And Hurricane Erin, which exploded in size and strength, certainly fits in that pattern.
Yeah, sounds like it does. NPR's Bill Chappell, thanks a lot.
Thanks, hey. Great to talk with you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
Thank you.
KEXE went on the air in 1976. This year, we lost federal funding like all of public media, but you have come forward. You have told us that KEXE matters. We're grateful for all of you, and especially for the folks that have been here from the beginning, people like Michael Goldberg and Gail Addison.
You know, for me and Gail, it's really been two things, a fabulous music education of all the music that we never imagined or knew anything about, and we're learning still every week. And then the other thing, of course, is that everybody we know through KEXE.
Yeah, we've made a lot of decisions in our life based on having access to this radio station, an extremely rare opportunity to learn a new skill and to share your love of music and to meet so many people through this station as well.
Support KEXE now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
We had been exporting jobs overseas. New data suggests we'll soon export those jobs to computers.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden Password Manager. From first jobs to first leases, Bitwarden can help manage sensitive information across all accounts and devices. Learn more at bitwarden.com. And by the United States Postal Service, offering stamps for purchase at over 40,000 supermarkets and drugstores and at wholesale clubs, Costco, Walmart, Sam's Club, and BJ's.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. We're only in the early stages of understanding just how much generative artificial intelligence will disrupt jobs. For now, AI tends to be enhancing workers, not necessarily replacing them. That's the highlight of a new report out of MIT, but there's one broad exception. Marketplace's Elizabeth Troval reports.
Adoption of generative AI did lead some firms to cut back spending on jobs that were often already being outsourced. Things like customer service, software engineering, and administrative tasks. That's according to MIT's new report. Pradyumna Chari is one of the authors.
Coding, writing, documentation, all of these are some simple aspects where we do think AI is already playing a big role in business.
But the report found mostly there were not big headcount reductions. It makes sense, since AI tools so far are often helping workers write emails or documents, says Harvard's Christopher Stanton.
Sort of the broad nature of work hasn't changed to reflect AI other than sort of some time savings.
And whether some jobs are augmented or automated may not be simply a matter of technology, says Tom Mitchell with Carnegie Mellon University.
It'll be a matter of businesses evolving their business processes to figure out how to incorporate these capabilities.
He says that's why procedures where it's easy to plug in AI, like customer service, are one of the first places we're seeing a shift. I'm Elizabeth Troval for Marketplace.
Stock index futures are down just slightly in the 0.1% range. The beleaguered U.S. microchip maker Intel just got a $2 billion lifeline from Japan's investment conglomerate SoftBank. This makes the company in Minato, just outside of Tokyo, one of Intel's biggest shareholders. This comes as the Trump administration is discussing the federal government buying a 10% stake in Intel.
In the statement, it was a joint statement released. They said that both sides want to invest in advanced technology and semiconductor innovation in the United States. Sources say that SoftBank's not going to be seeking a board seat or committing to buying Intel chips. And one analyst told the BBC that this is really a clear vote of confidence by SoftBank's investment in a chipmaker that has been struggling for decades after having kind of lost its foothold, particularly when it comes to AI chips and also when you compare it to its Asian rivals.
BBC reporter Katie Silver. The Air Canada strike is over. Flight attendants reached a settlement with the airline after a 9-hour session with a mediator. Hundreds of flights had been grounded since the weekend.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Yubico, makers of the YubiKey, protecting the applications and accounts that people and businesses rely on every day. YubiKey helps stop phishing attempts and hackers. YubiKey, still undefeated, the original passkey. More at yubico.com. And by Odoo, offering software that provides building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need.
Talk about privilege. The dollar is not just the currency of the United States. It is what's called the world's reserve currency, where people and institutions around the world park their money. But there's concern policies out of Washington could erode that status to the benefit of the euro and especially the yuan, the currency of China. Among other things, the dollar's been sinking. The dollar index is down 9.7% year to date. A familiar voice for us here on the Morning Report is Karen Petru, managing partner at Federal Financial Analytics. She gave a talk about this the other day. Karen, good morning.
Morning, David.
One of the things that made the U.S. dollar the special world currency, the reserve currency, is, I think, a kind of predictability of governance in the United States. These days, it seems less predictable. Tariffs on, tariffs off, tariffs delayed. There's questions about the stability of the U.S. federal court system. You think that plays into the dollar as a reserve currency?
I think it does. It's what the French once called a, quote, exorbitant privilege. It's even better than special. It reduces the cost of the U.S. deficit. It reduces the amount of interest we need to pay to attract dollar investments, which helps to keep down the cost of borrowing. It makes international trade a lot more efficient for U.S. companies because we have a lot less foreign exchange risk. It's a really cool deal. And it gives the United States geopolitical power, because if our economy dominates the world through the financial markets, then nations really need to listen to us when it comes to issues like sanctions.
We also have the independence of our central bank, the Federal Reserve, in play. That worries holders of our currency around the world?
It really does, because the way people hold dollars is almost entirely in treasury bonds. The United States issues $29 trillion worth of treasury bills to fund our deficit. So that's a huge amount, and that's one of the reasons the dollar is the reserve currency. But it is also such a big market that investors and traders really look to the Fed. And while they know the Fed isn't always right, they trust the Fed to try to be right. And they bet based on the expectation of Federal Reserve interest rates. If these become highly political, they are more likely to be really wrong. But even more importantly, they won't be anywhere near as predictable.
Now, you've been speaking to groups about some of this. What are you telling them? Keep an eye on this? Be very afraid? I mean, what's your overall message about threats to the U.S. dollar's status as the world's reserve currency?
Fundamentally, currencies are confidence games. We all hold dollars not because we think those green pieces of paper are worth anything, but because we trust the United States. Anything that threatens confidence threatens a currency status. And it would take a lot to dethrone the dollar's reserve currency status, but it's facing challenges that I don't think were ever envisioned or thought possible just a few months ago.
Karen Petru is managing partner at Federal Financial Analytics out of Washington. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
The dollar index is down another 0.2% this morning in Los Angeles. I'm David Brancaccio. It's the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Good morning. It's a minute before 6 o'clock. You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at kaxc.org. You can click on the donate button to support independent radio in northern Minnesota, and also lots of local stories for you to check out. I'm Jennifer Barr. We'll have more ahead from Morning Edition. And at 6:30, John Latimer joins me. We'll have National Native News, and we'll hear some phonology talkbacks before 7 o'clock. Patchy fog early this morning, gradually becoming sunny, high 75 to 80, lows tonight in the mid to upper 50s. Patchy fog again tomorrow morning with sunny skies later on and highs in the low 80s.